UK Wine Show, show number 102. Philip Shaw on Orange. This week's show?
I'm not growing grapes here to make money. That's crazy philosophy. No, try and make styles I want.
And in the news, Marlborough Harvest, a savalanche, global strategy to combat alcohol, and Sainsbury's introduced top 10 wines.
G'day, and welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 102. This week we're talking with Philip Shaw, wine consultant and winemaker at Orange. Not oranges, but Orange, the high-altitude wine region west of Sydney, Australia. But before Philip tells us about the region and why Rosemount Winery's ex-head of production has set up shop on the Great Dividing Range between Sydney and the desert, we have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. My first news story this week is that Marlborough in New Zealand, in the South Island, has had a huge grape harvest. And it's so big that the locals are calling it a savalanche, due to the fact that, of course, much of it is Sauvignon Blanc. According to New Zealand wine growers, the harvest is expected to be at least 25% bigger than last year's record of 121,000 tonnes, and 75% of it is Sauvignon Blanc. Demand for the Kiwi wine abroad has been outstripping supply for a while, so the bumper crop will help ease the situation, although in some areas like Hawke's Bay and Gisborne, smaller crops are expected. Looking ahead, New Zealand is set to produce more and more wine. This year, the area under vine increased by 2,000 hectares, bringing the national harvest coverage to around 27,000 hectares.
When you think about New Zealand growing by 2,000 hectares in a year compared to the total UK area under vine being 1,259 hectares, and people in the UK saying that a 477 hectare growth in 5 years, I'm not worried about supply outstripping demand in the UK. I'm more worried about the erosion of price from New Zealand. Now, we talked about the savalanche, but New Zealand Pinots are selling in New Zealand now for under £5.50 a bottle. Big changes in volume mean that distribution channels are not able to cope with it very well. Many wineries are dealing with the extra Pinot coming on board by creating two labels, a top tier and an entry level. And it's the entry level that's a good place to stick all this young fruit. But most New Zealand Pinots, around £10 a bottle, is still a great wine and easily beats most of the competition. Let's hope the Savalanche, and hopefully a Pinot Lanche, has put lots and lots of pressure on New Zealand, keeping the New Zealand Sav and Pinot prices under control as the UK pound continues to weaken against many of the wine-producing countries' currencies. What's up next, Jane?
Well, back here in the UK, Sainsbury's is introducing a top 10 display in its wine aisles to help customers shop for the right bottle. The idea has been sparked by research findings that show the majority of wine drinkers are still not that confident about picking the right wine. They say they've looked at how other retailers, such as Waterstones, have helped customers make a good selection when confronted by an enormous and varied choice. Basically, Sainsbury's is taking a leaf out of Waterstones' The Bookseller's Book. Warren Anderson from the Sainsbury's wine team says their top 10 wine section is designed to give customers the confidence to try something new, and they hope to assist shoppers broaden their knowledge and become a little bit more experimental. The top 10 display will feature in nearly 400 stores by the end of April and will reflect a different theme every 6 weeks. The first is going to be new wines, and others will include buyers' favourites, top 10 rosés and award winners. Wines will be ordered according to their characteristics, and food matching notes and endorsements will be included to help customers find a wine to match their taste. I think it's a great idea. It definitely works for me with books, so why not for wine? What do you think, Chris?
I'm not so sure about a top 10 based on personal recommendations from Sainsbury's. It can be modified quite a bit to shift large amounts of wine or possibly push a particular wine that's particularly profitable. Quite a tongue twister there. We have a top 30 on our sites, and the ratings are determined by people's tasting the wine. And even this has a problem. If people taste a great wine before, they tend to mark down even a good wine that follows. Different groups, such as girls, often like different wine to men, so some wines may rate badly, not because they're not good wines, but just because the wrong people have been tasting it. We have a fantastic 10-year-old Mosel Riesling that's simply brilliant, but most non-wine people can't stand it. It is a very good wine, Heck, yes, it's fantastic. Where does it rate? Near the bottom. Top 10s are fraught with problems, and if the shop determines that it's going to be used to drive sales, then the consumer might miss out on some great wines. But if the top 10 is based on consumer rankings, what you'll end up with is something that everybody likes, which will tend to mediocrity.
Well, I think it's a good idea, and also it's going to encourage people who didn't think that they were going to buy wine, but actually saw the top 10 and decided to buy something that week.
All right, fair enough. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, as you've heard in the news so far, we have more wine being produced and more help with buying it. So the World Health Organization may well struggle with their plans to reduce the amount of alcohol we drink. The harm caused by alcohol is now causing so much concern that the WHO has agreed a plan to develop a global strategy to reduce it. The need for such a plan is thought to be twofold. Firstly, there's the concern about the harm drinkers are doing to their own health. In the EU alone, some 55 million adults are estimated to be drinking to harmful levels, according to the EC. And it's estimated to be responsible for approximately 195,000 deaths each year in the EU. These are as a result of cancer, liver cirrhosis, suicides and neuropsychiatric conditions, as well as road traffic and other accidents and homicides. And this brings us to the second issue, which is the growing numbers of people who are suffering as a result of reckless or aggressive behaviour of those who have been drinking. In the UK, British Crime Survey figures show that in nearly half of all violent incidents, victims believed offenders to be under the influence of alcohol. And in more than a million attacks, the aggressors were believed to be drunk. It's also known that around 40% of domestic violence involves alcohol. The aim for the WHO strategy is to look at the best available evidence and best practices around the world and come up with a menu of recommended measures that member states can implement at a national level. The plan will be discussed when government representatives meet in Geneva in May for the annual World Health Assembly. And if an agreement is reached, the draft strategy is scheduled to be completed in 2010.
Is that it this week, Jane?
Actually, there's one last story that caught my eye about the wine chosen by the Royal Air Force for Prince William's recent Wings party. With RAF bosses still smarting from the charge that they've been squandering taxpayers' money on helicopter rides for the Prince, they were obviously a bit price-sensitive when it came to choosing the wine. When their regular supplier couldn't get hold of the wine they wanted, they searched the internet and came up with North Wales wine merchant John Lang's website, www.goodwineonline.co.uk. They bought 9 cases of Lisa McGuigan's Tempest 2 Verdello at £5.65 a bottle, and they could not be tempted by John to trade up. That's all from me, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk for the full stories.
Cheers, Jane. That finishes the news. This week's Spotlight carries on from last week's Spotlight on organic wines. And this week's Spotlight is biodynamic wines, and we take a look at vegetarianism. Biodynamic is based on a series of lectures given by Rudolf Steiner in 1924. The central aspect of biodynamics is that the farm as a whole is seen as an organism and therefore should be a closed self-nourishing system. Disease of organisms is not to be tackled in isolation, but is a symptom of a problem in the whole organism. Rudolf Steiner felt that the recent change to chemical fertilizers and farms was a detrimental move for the soil. He developed a series of preparations that are to be applied to soils. Field preparations for stimulating humus formation. Horn manure, paired by stuffing cow manure into a horn of a cow and buried in the ground in autumn and left to decompose over the winter months. Crushed powdered quartz, prepared by stuffing it into a horn of a cow and buried into the ground in spring and taken out in autumn. It can be mixed with horn manure, but usually prepared on its own. Dealing with pests, such as field mice, have a more complex process associated with them, depending on what the pest is to be targeted. For example, field mice are to be countered by deploying ashes prepared from field mice skins when Venus is in the Scorpius constellation. The tie-up with stars is fundamental to biodynamics. The moon travels around the Earth once every 28-29 days, and biodynamics is based on the belief that in going around the Earth, the moon passes in front of the constellations. As it does so, it collects energy from the stars and constellations and focuses it on Earth. So the moon acts as a lens for collecting and focusing energy of each constellation in turn onto the Earth. Depending on the energy of the stars, it determines the optimum time for various activities in the vineyard. On the 16th April 1993, A research article in Science magazine compared the soil quality and financial performance of biodynamic and conventional farms in New Zealand. The article reported that biodynamic farms proved in most enterprises have soils of higher biological and physical qualities, significantly greater organic matter, content and microbial activity, more earthworms, better soil structure, lower bulk density, easier penetrability and thicker topsoil. The study compared biodynamic farms with adjacent conventional farms. However, other studies have shown little difference between organic and biodynamic. Vegan and vegetarian wines. It's surprising to think that wine made from grapes is not vegetarian. But sadly, very few bottles of wine are labelled as suitable for vegetarians or vegans. There are two issues associated with this. The first is that many wines are suitable, however, winemakers do not label their wines. Perhaps they consider wine to be similar to fruit and vegetables. You never see a tomato labelled as suitable for vegetarians. However, there are many wines that are not suitable for vegans and vegetarians. The reason is that many commercial wines use egg and animal products to clean the wine before bottling. This is known as fining. Often after wine is made, there are small particles suspended. This creates a haze or perhaps aggressive tannins. The particles can be removed by adding additives known as fining agents. They work by attracting particles in the wine and become bigger and heavier and sinking quickly to the bottom. The wine can be then drained off without particles and fining agents. The problem is that wine may contain trace elements of fining agents. And since typically fining agents include egg whites, milk, fish bladders, that may make them unsuitable for vegetarians and vegans. Not all wines use fining agents. Many of the more expensive wines designed for aging naturally throw a sediment, including the part that the fining agents would normally remove. However, in the UK and most countries, the absence of fining agents does not legally need to be mentioned on the label, leaving vegetarians and vegans unaware of the suitability of the wine. So in other words, there's lots of wine that's suitable for vegetarians and vegans, just they're not labelled correctly. This ends this week's Spotlight. I wrote this and the other Spotlight on oak barrels about a year or so ago. And if you'd like to get the current Spotlights, you can subscribe to 3050's newsletter. It comes out monthly and has loads of great info on it, on regions, news, book reviews, as well as what we're up to at 3050. Simply go to 3050.co.uk, click on the Contact Us button at the top left-hand side, fill in the details, and make sure you select under Inquiry Type Newsletter and where you heard about us, the UK Wine Show. While there, you can give me some feedback on the comments section. From the feedback I'm getting, you really enjoyed the spotlight on oak and the book reviews, which is fantastic. I had a nice email from Carton. I think that's how you say it. I'm not very good at pronouncing Norwegian names. Carton really liked the oak spotlight and the book reviews. My current series in the spotlight in our newsletter is on global warming after my trip to Barcelona. I'll be running through that in the UK Wine Show, probably in about a month or two's time. I really should have a poll on global warming, but this week's poll is all about bottle sizes. This week, it's the last week for which you to have your say about bottle sizes. The question was, wine is mainly sold in 750ml bottles, but some producers are putting wine in 500ml bottles to share between the two. Do you think smaller bottles are a good idea? Do go to our website, 3050.co.uk. And don't forget that 3050 is a sponsor of the UK Wine Show, and 3050 is also the UK's leading wine tasting company. Here at the UK Wine Show, we are big fans of English wine, and myself and Sandra, our news reporter, headed down to an English wine trade tasting. While there, I got some great interviews with some English producers, which we'll be releasing over the next 6 months or so. I also got to try quite a bit of the current release of 2007 vintage, which, from talking to everybody, was very small and mainly damaged by rain during the flowering set early on in the year. While many producers lamented the lack of volume, the quality gain was of a good standard. From a personal point of view, I went looking for wines to run our tastings as part of 3050. Wherever possible, we always try to start with an English wine, and usually it's either a rosé or a Bacchus or a sparkling wine, depending on the budget of the tasting. On my tasting this week, I was on the lookout for a moderately priced rosé. The two I really liked was Bedindon's Gribble Bridge at around $7.20 a bottle, which we'll probably list subject to me negotiating with them in the next couple of days. I still prefer Camel Valley's 2006 rosé, and Chapel Downs are doing a great job as well. But I think the Bedindon rosé is a very good rosé at a fairly sensible price. Afterwards, I popped over to Bibendum's on-premier Bordeaux tasting, and I got to sample a very nice range of 2007 Bordeaux's, and earlier vintages as well. Everything from Cheval Blanc to Chateau Equium and Kerwin. Now, I'd like to give you some great recommendations, but to be honest, I've tasted a fair range of top-end Bordeaux in the past, but I'm a novice with such young Bordeaux, so I think I'll keep my opinions to myself for a few years while I work my way through some vintages and I get to see how they evolve in the bottle. If you ever want to try some top Bordeaux wines, do go along to next year's Bordeaux tasting by Bibendum. I think tickets to the public were £35 entry, which, to be honest, is a bargain given some of the wines you can get to try. While tasting, I always spit out the wine, but after I'd finished at the Bibendum tasting, I did enjoy myself on a 95 Chateau Equium, and it was very good. Possibly not as good, but certainly very good wine was my star from the English wine tasting. Now, if you're a wine puritan, you'll probably kill me for this, but I really like the dessert wine known as Northern Star. It's a nice wine made in England by Eglantine Vineyards at around 18 quid for a half bottle. I thought it was very good. Now, they have cheated. England is cold, but it's not cold enough to make ice wine. They've cheated by freezing the grapes and making the ice wine from the juice. Now, from an environmental position, I don't think it's a good idea, but it does make for a lovely full-on wine, which is very, very nice. It's good enough to not worry about whether you should chastise them for making such a naughty wine, and then buying loads, because it's a lot cheaper than, say, Canadian ice wine, which is their competition. On that, I have a show coming up with Bruce Walker from the Canadian Vintners Association on ice wine. But this week, we'll be talking with Philip Shaw and exploring the high country, cool climate boutique wine region known as Orange in Australia. Let's have a listen to what Philip has to say. Hi, I'm here with Philip Shaw from Philip Shaw Wines. How are you, Philip?
Oh, great, Chris. You're welcome.
Excellent. We're up in sunny Orange. Well, not quite sunny today.
No, it's actually raining. I've been away overseas the last 2 weeks, but we've had a reasonable amount of rain over the last 2 weeks, which is nice after really 3 or 4 years of drought. It was a soft winter. We didn't have that much rain. Since then, it's been raining on pretty on and off. So everything's looking very lush and green.
Yeah, I've noticed it's really green. It's not that sort of dried out Aussie look that you're normally used to. We're going to be talking about Orange today. Why is it called Orange?
Well, I think some guy from England did that. A lot of the towns around here are named after dukes and that of European origin. So that's the reason. We're certainly too cool to grow oranges here.
Known really for stone fruit, really, wasn't it?
More palm fruit. Apple's the main fruit here. And to some degree, cherries. Cherries have become quite strong over the last few years, mainly because there's a fairly big export market. And this is the latest region in Australia, besides Tasmania, southern Tasmania. And it fits nicely with Chinese New Year. So, in fact, a lot of cherries get exported for Chinese New Year. And being a lake region, we are, it fits perfectly.
A lake region?
Lake, you know, the fruit.
Oh, the fruit ripens late.
Yeah.
Yeah, lake region. Okay. What's the defining thing about Orange? Because, well, just so people know where it is, you're, what, 3 hours inland from Sydney over the Blue Mountain Range?
Yeah, we're really due west of Sydney. To be in the Orange region, as far as grape growing, you've got to be above 600 metres, and the grapes generally are grown between 750 and up to over 1,000 metres.
What does the altitude do to the wines?
It's a very cool region. We've been once over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 degrees centigrade. That was in 2002. So it's very cool, cool winters. It just gives us a better window for longer ripening and better flavour qualities, more vibrant fruit characters.
More acidity coming through in the wines?
Yeah, definitely. We rarely have to add acid.
A lot of people talk about the soils, you know, it's just beside an old volcano which chucked out a bit of basalt.
Yeah, that has some inputs on the style too. I chose this property because it's really the break between basalt and going into shaley soils. So you've got some good depth of soil, but shaley, limestone. The whole area used to be a big inland sea, or I don't know what it was inland at that stage. It certainly was a sea, and there's 600 metres of limestone under the whole of a region, so it's very impacted by all sorts of soils and that.
What would you say the main soil is? Is it just a real... And how deep is that limestone? Do the grapes get to the limestone?
Yeah, they do. We actually, our topsoil is red and it looks like it's volcanic, but in fact it isn't. Along the western side, generally, of the Great Divide, which runs north-south and along the east coast of Australia, topsoil is generally wind-blown soil from the central Australia, and probably 150, 200 millimetres of the topsoil is that fairly low, sea, wind-blown, red, very friable soil.
Okay, and then you've got the limestone.
And then we go into red, lovely red friable soil.
What's friable soil?
Oh, it allows the water to, it's very crumbly and allows the water to penetrate through.
Okay, high porosity.
Yeah, it's perfect soil for growing grapes.
And what sort of grapes are you growing up here?
Well, being a new region, or relatively new region, the vine's been planted since early 80s in this region. You don't know, so you start with everything and then work out what works.
Process elimination.
And then you eliminate, that's right. You graft over or pull out while you don't think's working so well. And that was my intention. My favourite varieties are Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and that's why I selected. I've had a lot of close association with Burgundy in the past from France. And so that was my intent, but I planted other varieties, in fact, because I was after the best wines, not necessarily... close my mind to what else is available, and you do all your research and that and come up with the figures, but all the things we know, there's a lot more we don't know, so what and how they all combine, you're not sure. So the best thing is to plant a reasonable amount of each better known varieties or varieties you're interested in and see which worked out, and that's what I've done.
And what do you think is working out?
Well, Carbonate's a bit cool here, except in a warm year. We're trying to overcome that by a lot of work in the vineyard and cropping extremely low. I'm not sure yet on that. Pinot is showing huge promise, gets better every year. Chardonnay and Shiraz are the ones looking best.
Shiraz, right?
What you Shiraz. People often pick me up what I'm calling. I thought, well, I don't know what I'm calling.
Shiraz, Syrah, Shiraz.
Anyway, that's what I call it. Depends on the aspect, really. If we're on an easterly aspect or a southerly aspect, it's quite cool. And, you know, being reasonable slopes on the outer ridge of a vineyard, it's quite suited for varieties like Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc. While the northerly aspects for the later ripening fruit, like Cabernet and Shiraz and Merlot to some degree.
Yeah, because we're in the southern hemisphere, the northern is facing the equator, the warmer side, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the warmer side.
And northern hemisphere, it's the south slopes.
So, yeah, it's the opposite, yeah.
Okay, so how many grape growers are up here?
It's about 50 now.
15 or 50?
50 growers.
Oh, quite a few.
So it's scattered quite widely here, and you've got to drive around. And the same with wineries, I think there's 15 wineries now, but they're very scattered around, and so you don't drive up one road and find them all, no.
Me and a mate of mine were up here, we were driving around trying to find the vineyards, and they were all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, they vary in size from quite small, biggest vineyards, 500 hectares.
Well, it's still a good size, though.
Yeah, and there's quite a number of quite reasonable-sized vineyards here.
Originally, you did some work for Rosemount. You were the head winemaker there?
I was in charge of production of Rosemount, and then South Corp after that.
Yep, okay. And then you packed it in to come here. They're available in the UK, aren't they? Well, they've got a distributor there.
They're limited availability. They will become available reasonably soon, more freely.
We tasted a reasonable range of your wines just before we did the show. We tasted, what, Sauvignon Blanc? Three different Chardonnays.
A Pinot and a Shiraz Viognier.
Yep, so quite a mixture there. I also did a wee bit of tasting before we came in here, and I noticed the first winery I went to, the wines I thought were actually quite flabby for what I was expecting. You know, people talk about cool climate, I expect wines with loads of acidity in them. And I was a bit worried that maybe that wasn't quite the cool climate that people have been talking about. But your wines got a lot of zesty freshness to them.
I think it depends a lot on the winemaker and when they picked them, and that they may have been picked late, very late. I mean, even very cool regions seem to be able to get fruit ripe over the last few years. We've been in severe drought, and that would have had some impact on those people.
Why would the drought have caused the problem?
They're ripening a lot earlier, and with low crops, you're getting them ripening more during the warmer period.
Oh, the vines have got less cropping because of the dryness.
Oh, extremely low cropping, some of them.
Yep.
It didn't seem to affect us so much. We crop very low anyway, so the vines weren't stressed anyway. So our aim is to crop around 5 tonnes a hectare, so it wasn't that stressed, and I think that's probably why we're not suffering from that. They may have picked them a lot later than we do. We try and get the fruit to show its vibrant fruit characters at a fairly low BOMA, and that's by cropping low that's achieved. And we do a lot of work in the vineyard by pulling leaves off and pulling shoots off and pulling bunches off. And I think that achieves during those really stressed, hard times, putting that effort in, you're rewarded from it.
You were talking when we were tasting the rosé that the rosé's dry, which is quite nice. I'm not a big fan of sweet rosés, but dry rosé. But you said it was quite heavily oxidised, which is a bit unusual because the Aussies like to, you know, almost reductive winemaking as a general rule. Why did you go down the oxidative process for your rosé?
Because I don't generally like the Aussie rosé. red fruit, you always have a bit of tannins there, and you can approach that different ways. Some varieties like Grenache are fairly low in that tannin, so it's not such a problem. Other varieties, they've got a reasonably harsh tannin, and by oxidising you remove that tannin and also stabilise the colour, which is another important factor. Initially the juice looks brown, and it's done at the juice stage, but after that, that colour drops out, unstable colour, and the wine stays much stabler. Rosés tend to have a relatively short life, but by doing this you have two purposes. One's to stabilise and lengthen the life of wine, but also to give a much softer palate, and that wine's totally dry, it's no sweetness.
Yeah, a lot of people, they add sugar just to soften out, to hide the tannins with the sugar.
Yeah, yeah, and that makes sense if you're making that style.
What's the grapes you've used?
Merlot's the main variety in it, but also Shiraz, Pinot and a little bit of Cab Franc.
The Pinot, quite light in style, you know, almost Burgundian and different. I've been travelling through Otago drinking a bit of Pinot there, and yeah, quite heavy, those Pinots, whereas yours is back to a very light style, quite floral. What are you trying to achieve there?
Well, that's the way Pinot, to me, is the way it should be. Pinot's an elegant variety, and it's quite powerful perfume, florals. And that's what I'm after. I think if you aim to make a Shiraz from Pinot and the style, a lot of Pinots look more like Shiraz. They do Pinot, and they pick very late, high alcohols. I think you've lost the charm of Pinot, and I see Pinot needing to be light and elegant. And these wines will age extremely well, crop extremely low. We leave on skins a long time, but we don't pick ripe. So. That's the style I believe Pinot should be.
You were talking, you had a couple of problems with the Pinots early on with some eucalyptus trees, and also sort of had them facing the wrong way. Do you want to comment on sort of what you've had to do as you've learnt how best to grow the wines in Orange?
Yeah, it's coming. It's how to adapt to the site we're on. Orange goes from 600 metres up to over 1,000, as I mentioned, and span is over 4 weeks growing. So it's like moving from southern France to northern Europe, in fact. But with Pinot, we found I planted initially on northerly face.
Warm face, yeah.
And also I have clones of D5V12, which is an old clone. The Swiss clone, chosen because of its resistance to botrytis and other rots, because they get a lot of rain at the wrong time. Well, what we found, that was fine, but that wasn't necessarily a big problem for us. It can be a little problem some years, but the wines weren't that great. In Australia, because we don't only limited areas have phylloxera, it's very hard to get new clones into Australia. And most of what was considered good clones weren't available in Australia, so I just had to use what we could get.
Yep.
But once they better clones came available, I then grafted over, and we moved to the southern face, which was cooler. So it was some of Pinot got grafted over twice, and then ended up being grafted to Shiraz because it's the wrong aspect. But yeah, that's all about being in a new area. You've got to be willing to change and
a bit pricey though.
Yeah, very expensive. I'm not growing grapes here to make money. That's crazy philosophy. No, try and make styles I want.
Yeah, okay. What do you think the wines are to look out for in Orange in the future? We've talked a wee bit about the Chardonnays.
I think Chardonnay, I think it all depends on where you're located. I haven't got Riesling planted here, but one of the vineyards got some very shaley soil. And I think growing a superb Riesling, very Moselle Germanic style, very light, elegant, very limey, great wine. Pinot, you need to be high. Merlot, we're just coming to grips with. We've only got one clone at the moment. We're starting to get new clones, and I think that'll be a great area for Merlot. One problem with Merlot throughout the world is, in fact, that Merlot is a very poor setter, very uneven cropping. But we find we can get perfect cropping, perfect set every year.
Was that, do you not have wind or rain issues?
Yeah, we have all those issues, but I think because we are very high up, we've got a very good UV, and that overcomes that problem for set.
You mentioned UV. A lot of people say that the UV puts stress on the vine, and as a result, you quite often either land up with thicker skins, which is what they sort of say about Argentinian wines, and some people reckon that New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc has that sort of intensity, maybe because of the big UV hole that appears over New Zealand. Do you think UV is an important part of Orange?
Yeah, I believe it is. I mean, you go to most high regions of the world and look at flowers, and they always have a real intensity of colour. And I think it's the same with orange. It's a real intensity of colour. The idea of stress is rubbish. I mean, vines don't get stressed through UV. They get stressed by heat. We're not hot. We don't get sunburn very, you know, in the whites. We don't get sunburn. We use dappled light. We carefully pick our fruit, so we end up with dappled light.
What, but so you've got a bit of leaf covering the grapes?
Slightly. And I think any region, I've noticed people totally denude the vine. I think it's probably a method we should show some countries. I think it's a bit of a torture. I don't know why people do that. Certainly I can understand the vine being open and having sunlight, but not being to a point where all the fruit just standing out there in the raw sun, no. And I think it's more affected by heat than it is by UV.
What do you think UV has influences the wine to?
Well, a whole plant's growth depends on UV. That's what, and most areas where it's got a lot of UV, it's also got a lot of heat. But in a very high area, you've got a lot of UV, but you don't have a lot of heat. And to a fair degree, that's ideal for a plant, for growth. And you notice here, if you do get rain and that and everything's ideal, you do get the growth and you do get the colour in the fruit. You get a lot of intensities. No, I don't agree with that theory. I just think it's heat's the main problem. And you take those three Bordeaux reds, to me, not my favourite vintage because they've been overstressed. I don't think they've been
too hot.
I don't think it was the heat as much as the stress.
Or maybe even water because they're not allowed to irrigate.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a problem.
Okay, then, Philip, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much.
Fine. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Philip. Next week, we find out about ice wine. No, I'm not going back to the Northern Star wines, delicious as it is. We're talking with Bruce Walker, head of the Canadian Vintners Association, about the delicious and one of my favourite styles, ice wine. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.